Hello, I'm Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable and to give you tips for making your life easier. Tonight, I am going to end the series in domestic awareness, Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And my special guest tonight is Vicki Doolittle. She is the executive director of SUCASA, Ending Domestic Violence. And I'm happy to have her on. I have known Vicki for about 2-3 years now, and she is a joy to work with. She is very knowledgeable on this subject. We are going to be talking about if you or somebody that you know has to go into a domestic violence shelter, what is the experience like? What kind of services can you or somebody else get? That is what we're going to concentrate on tonight. But hi, Vicki, how are you?
Hi, Julianne. I'm good. Thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you for being on.
You're welcome.
I am going to go through, if you don't mind, kind of what SUCASA is about from the information that you sent me. Would that be okay?
Of course.
Thank you. Okay, SUCASA has been serving victims of domestic violence and their children for 35 years in an effort to break the intergenerational cycle of violence. The organization was founded in 1979 by Petra Medeles, a survivor, who out of her own home answered crisis calls and housed women and children. Since then, SUCASA has expanded services to include 2 shelters, permanent housing, walk-in services, community education and awareness, and an administrative headquarters. We remain dedicated to our founders' belief that one right step leads to another, and we are deeply committed to the principle that every person has the right to live free from violence and the threat of violence. Our mission is to empower individuals and families to live free from domestic abuse and build partnerships with communities to end domestic violence. That's beautiful. That's a great way of stating it. And Vicki, can you tell us a little bit about your background, please?
Oh, sure. Well, I have a master's in counseling, and I've been working at SUCASA as director for about 6 years. Before I came to SUCASA, I was working at, in various social service and community organizations, always in the social services field. But this is my first time working in domestic violence, and though there are a lot of similarities between working with victims of DV and other populations, this is quite a unique challenge in its own way. But my background is in counseling, and so I have kind of been primarily focused on that, but in this position I'm doing just a little bit of everything, really.
You are. You're an amazing woman. Vicki has taken on so many roles within both of the shelters and the community outreach program and just reaching out and writing grants, getting funding. You wear so many hats, Vicki.
Well, actually, it's been really a good challenge and one that I'm sure that every executive director, really any nonprofit, but particularly domestic violence shelters, everyone wears a lot of hats in doing this kind of work and really expands you as a person and a professional.
Yes, it does. So what would you say would be one of the biggest challenges that the shelter and the domestic violence community face?
Well, of course, the answer that most, you know, comes to mind right away, of course, is funding. It's keeping the doors open. Most of the shelters, I would say probably all domestic violence shelters, but certainly within the state of California, are dependent upon government funds for the most part. And the big challenge for, especially for SUCASA, is to diversify our funding so we're not overly dependent on government funds, because about 3 years ago, there was a big threat that all of our state funding would just go away in one fell swoop. And so we learned a lesson from that: diversify, diversify, diversify. So I think going after private funding, looking for donors, trying to find people and organizations in the community that will support us, that understand the cause and are willing to really put resources behind the work that we do, I'd say that's the biggest challenge.
Right, and then it's educating those funders also about what exactly The shelters do. And the crucial support system that you supply to the community that is so needed now.
Exactly. Well, you know, you're right, and you have a very good point, because of the nature of the work that we do in this field, there's so much that is confidential, there's so much that we cannot disclose, that it is a little difficult to know how to get the word out to the community, not only for prevention's sake, but as you're saying, also to see if we can get more supporters and get more donors. So getting the word out in a way that is not going to in any way compromise the identity or the confidentiality of the people that we serve and risk their safety, that is also a challenge.
Can you talk a little bit about if a person is in a DV situation and they feel like they must go to a shelter, that whole confidentiality part of it?
Sure. Well, the rule of thumb is that, of course, if a person is in immediate danger and they need to leave the home and go into a safe environment, that the idea is get them as far away from that particular dangerous situation as possible. So I think what you'll find in all DV shelters is the general principle and the rule is that we will not accept anyone who lives within at least a 3-mile, but it's usually a 5-mile radius of the location of our shelters. So in general, we're going to take in families that are from out of the immediate area for their safety's sake.
Right, and then just having to leave the comfort or whatever of their homes, the knowingness of their neighborhoods and their friends, and especially bringing children in, they have to pull them out of school. They have to stop working and then come into the shelter to sometimes literally save their lives.
That's right. You know, and many times, I'd probably even say most often, the families come in with just the clothes that are on their backs. They don't have anything when they are literally running for their lives. And we take them in, and that's why for the first 2 or 3 days, that is the most crucial time, that is the most dangerous time, that if that particular family is being followed by the perpetrator, that is a very dangerous time. So we have a policy that we keep the families in the shelter not to leave for at least 3 days. So we supply all their needs. There are no charges. There's no fees for any of the services that we provide at Tsukas. So we're fortunate to, you know, have, well, like I said, the funding that covers all those costs, all their food, all their shelter, all their clothing, everything they need, we supply to them.
Yes, and then also clothing and toys for the children, and services for whatever they need, psychological services, legal services, housing services.
It's, all of that.
Yeah, it's incredible. And typically, how long does a woman or a family stay within emergency sheltering?
Within the emergency shelter, it's about 30 to 45 days. In certain rare instances, we'll go ahead and extend that, but generally 30 to 45 days. And the idea behind that is that we want the immediate crisis to pass. We want that family to get out of harm's way, to become stable, and then to feel like they're able to move into the next stage, the next step, if you will. But 30 to 45 days is what it takes for them to really get to that point.
And what is the typical course that a woman would go through once she comes into the shelter?
Well, the first thing that starts the whole process is a call to our hotline. All the shelters have one number that is published, and that's what we have at Tsukasa. That's our hotline number, and everything starts with that phone call. So, for example, even if some of your listeners have a friend and they're sure that he or she is in danger and needs help, if they call on behalf of that friend, we would just say, sorry, we can't help you. You've got to have that person. person make the phone call. It's important that they initiate the call. So that kind of triggers everything, sets everything in motion, and a very thorough assessment takes place over the phone, an evaluation of the risk, determination of whether they live within our, you know, within the 5-mile radius. If so, they're given 3 referrals to other shelters. If it happens that they're a very good candidate and we feel it's a good mix and we have the space in our shelter, then the intake process is conducted right then and there over the phone. And that can take an hour, could take 2 hours. Again, just going through all the important information, both for the sake of the family coming in and for the sake of our staff and the organization, make sure it's a good fit. And then if it is, then arrangements are made to pick up the family at a safe location. Either we pick them up ourselves or we have some other safe transportation bring them into the shelter. And do you want me to talk about what happens once they arrive?
Yes, and I just want to add something else also, mm-hmm. Vicki. When a person calls in to the shelter or the hotline, they need to call from a safe phone. They need to call from a phone that is not like a cell phone that the abuser is paying for the services, correct?
That's right. In fact, that's a good point, Julianne, because what we'll do, the very first question out of the mouths of the hotline worker is, you know, are you safe? Are you in a safe place? Oftentimes, you're right, they'll be calling from the home phone, just kind of keeping an eye on the door. He could be coming home or she could be coming home any minute, and we'll say, oh, sorry, call back. When you are safe, when you are someplace where, you know it's going to be safe. Making sure that they're calling from a safe location and not on a cell phone that can be traced.
Right. Yeah, I have received some of those calls where the woman was just absolutely panicked, and and right there and then, the hotline workers have to work with trying to do safety planning with them, right mm-hmm. there and then before they can even get to the next step of possibly coming in for shelter. So sometimes it can be really crucial for the caller to just be in that safe place, to be a little bit calmed down so that they can, they can get the information out clearly or have somebody that can help them calm them down so that they can get the help as soon as possible and get them out of a dangerous situation.
Absolutely. And you're right. I think a big part of the training, as you know, for those of us working the hotline, really is to practice being a calm listener, a good listener, and like you say, being flexible and intuitive enough to know, this is a caller who really needs immediate safety planning, and that's what we're going to do. Or this is a caller who needs, 3 referrals, or just a good listener, so... You're right. It's a kind of an art, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, and sometimes it's a little difficult to get the caller to state succinctly what they need because they are in panic mode.
Right. Right. So, and yes, I think that it really is true. And to have our workers be, skilled and experienced enough to be able to know, to ask the questions that are more likely to elicit the responses and more likely to help calm down the person calling. Because you're right, that's probably one of the most intense times.
It is. So once the woman and possibly her family come in, the children, what is the next step then once they get to the safe meeting spot?
Well, they'll be picked up by someone from our organization and brought into the shelter. And, again, probably they have very few of their own personal belongings. So one of the first things in the goal when we first bring in a family is to, as quickly as possible, help them feel as comfortable and at home as possible, knowing this is going to be a really scary time, particularly for the kids. There are, certain steps and procedures that we follow as far as providing you know, like welcome packages, welcome bags and toys for the kids, make sure that they have everything they need in their room. They're assigned to a room. Most of the time, if there's a family with several children, they get their own room. In some cases, they might share. But, yeah, to make sure that those basic needs are taken care of course, meeting the staff, meeting other residents that are living there, and just give them time to, you know, settle in and be, just get, you know, kind of get grounded in the new space.
Right.
Prepare meals if they're, you know, if they're hungry or whatever. So kind of that's what we try to do initially. And I believe that our staff are real sensitive to the fact that that isn't the time to really necessarily barrage them with, you know, all the paperwork and doing this and signing that. Most of the time that's going to happen the following day, you know, when things kind of calm down a little bit.
Right. And the staff are very good about welcoming the new residents and just making them, you know, feel, you know, like temporarily at home, because that's what it is. It is a temporary home, but trying to get that safety slowly reestablished, that, you know, we are there to help them. Mm-hmm. And it's a good thing that they've made that decision to come in and make that huge step, because for a lot of women, it is a huge step. Doesn't it take some women like an average of 7 times before they finally leave their abusive situation?
That's exactly what it takes. Yeah, that's what we have seen, that, yeah, many times it's repeated attempts to leave. And there are very good reasons why many victims choose not to leave right at that point. But eventually, and like you say, after about 7 attempts, that's when they finally say, enough already. I'm really doing this.
So what are some of those reasons why they decide to stay with their abuser?
Well, I think one of the main ones, and what we've certainly seen in recent years with the economy being so bad, is that many times that it's a financial reason. You know, they're financially attached and to the, in many cases, the husband or the male, and that he's the primary breadwinner. And so the thought of uprooting the children and leaving and not having any source of income, or not knowing how they're going to be able to get that, I think so financial reasons are probably one of the main reasons. But there are so many others, and I think there's so many very insidious psychological reasons why people stay in relationships that are really bad, that are even dangerous. You know, it's taking a risk and venturing out into the unknown is frightening. Even if you're in a very bad situation, making the decision to leave and step into the unknown is scary for any of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even more so for a person who has been, you know, beaten down literally, physically, emotionally, every way. It's a very, very difficult thing to feel like you're worth making that effort, that you are a worthy human being and you can do this. And doing it for yourself and your children, I think, is, you know, it takes a lot of internal fortitude, which many people in that position don't have enough of.
Right. The courage to leave.
Right.
Right. So if any of the listeners would like to call in, the number is 800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. And I'm talking to Vicki Doolittle, the executive director of Sue Casa Ending Domestic Violence. So, Vicki, I was reading some of the statistics that you sent over, and they were shocking as to how many people have called in and how many, you know, services that have gone through Sue Casa and other DV shelters. Can you talk about that a little bit, please?
Let's see. I've got some information I can share on the need. Or are you more interested at this point, Julianne, in what how many we've served and things like that?
Yes. How many has Sue Casa served? How many women and children? Yes, thank you.
Yeah, we have actually in a given year, and I can use last year as a really good example of this, we've served slightly over 3,000 individuals. And how that breaks down is, of course, it's a lot of crisis calls that we receive in a year, roughly 1,500, a little under 1,500 crisis calls. We also had 167 adults and children come into our shelters. And that also includes 65 individuals that walked in and received non-shelter-based services. We do an awful lot of community outreach, presentations, lectures at their local colleges, at service organizations. And last year, about 1,300 local residents attended these presentations. So we're out there trying to touch as many lives and help as many folks as we can.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I know that you do the DV awareness over at Cal State Long Beach every year, correct?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it was just held last week. They had a really impressive turnout for the clothesline project at Cal State Long Beach, and we were represented there.
Yeah, and that's really powerful. It's if you're curious about what the clothesline project is about, it is a show of T-shirts that victims and survivors, and I really want to stress the word survivor here, because once you get past that point and you leave, you are a survivor, period. But it's powerful to see the messages on these T-shirts that these women and sometimes girls put out, like, this is the statement that they want to make to their abuser and to the world. It's like, I am not going to be beaten down by whatever somebody else decide to dish out to me. I am going to stand up and speak out against these atrocious acts sometimes. And it's incredibly powerful. I've been in a couple of them, and I just moved to tears.
You know, you're right, and it really is. I think the first time a person sees these displayed, and they string clothesline, literally clothesline from across, in the case of the university, the quad, with all these brightly painted and with inscriptions, big T-shirts, and it really is a very powerful visual impact. And you mentioned, Julianne, the speak out, and the other thing that happens on the campus on that day is there is a speak out in the evening for survivors to have an opportunity to go up to the microphone and share with everyone in there around there a little about their personal story. And that's also incredibly moving.
Yes, it is. Most definitely. And just to be able to make a public statement to hopefully help other people heal also it's incredible. It's powerful.
Yeah, I think that's how that's so much of how healing takes place, is having the courage to share your story. And you never know, you might just be planting a seed, or you might be helping someone else to find the courage to face his or her demons also, and to begin that process.
Exactly, because just getting those first few words out sometimes can be the scariest, because sometimes people don't know how to state it. How do you take all of this internal pain and externalize and say, I can't take this anymore, and I deserve a better life, I deserve to live, I deserve to be treated better?
And that's a very, very significant point you're making, because I think a lot of what we attempt to do, and I know at other shelters too, but is to help rebuild and reestablish the sense of self-esteem. When people come into our shelter, we spend an awful lot of time doing that, building back that confidence, that sense of self, the worthiness, because it's really, you know, it's been crushed under the weight of all the, you know, the in some cases years of abuse. And so building it back and believing again in yourself is a big part of what we're trying to do.
That's huge. And that right there, just trying to plant that seed of self-esteem again, can be completely life-changing.
Mm-hmm.
When we come back from commercial, let's talk a little bit more about the emergency shelter experience and then the transitional shelter also, okay?
Sure, sounds good.
All right, thank you, Vicki.
Mm-hmm.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at three campuses: Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School for sponsoring Psych One-on-One. I'm back with Vicki Doolittle, the executive director of SUCASA, Ending Domestic Violence. And we are talking about if a person goes into emergency sheltering, what the experience is like. What can you expect so that you have a little information behind you before you decide to make that huge decision to leave and possibly save your life and the life of your children? So after a person is in the shelter for like 2-3 days and they're past that initial crisis point, what happens in the process then?
Well, we have a number of structured groups and activities that are kind of built into the calendar or the schedule over at the shelter. Throughout the course of a day, I guess a typical day may sort of look like if a person has appointments, or, you know, in some cases they may have medical appointments or court appearances or some other social service appointments. Those would be scheduled and calendared throughout their stay. What we do that I'm sure is not unusual, but the other thing that some people may not be aware of is that anytime a child, a school-age child, comes into shelter, he or she has the right and the opportunity to go to school, to enroll in the local schools. And we've got arrangements with a local school district near our shelters so that the kids do go to school while they're in shelter. So in the morning, the moms will walk them to school and then pick them up in the afternoon. And a lot of what goes on during the day are support groups, domestic violence awareness groups. There's some peer-led support groups. We've also got counselors who facilitate groups. We have a professional therapist who comes in and facilitates a group with the folks as well. A lot of the time, we have some outside activities. People coming in from other agencies to provide certain groups on different topics or different recreational or therapeutic activities. I'm thinking of yoga classes. Mm-hmm. In some cases, we bring people in to do beauty makeovers, things like that. And the other thing, of course, that takes place is they prepare their own meals. We buy all the food for them and stuff, but they're responsible for preparing their own meals and, of course, doing all the cleanup and keeping the house clean, so a little of that, that type of thing.
Yes, and I think it's wonderful, too. I've seen this time and time again after the initial period, after a few days of getting used to, okay, this is my temporary new normal here as being a resident. Then I see friendships happening. I see support from other survivors, new friendships happening with the children, and we've got this nice playground area where they can run around and, you know, just be kids and be safe. And it's really beautiful to see a lot of those friendships beginning to emerge out of a really tragic, sometimes coming into the shelter, all that energy. And it's really amazing to see how a lot of the women end up working together.
Well, you're right. And, you know, interestingly, I just before I called you for this interview, I was over at the shelter, and we had some guests over, and I met and spoke to a couple of the residents, and exactly what you're saying is what happened, because they said, "Oh, Vicki, I want to talk to you," and I said, "Okay." And she said, "Well, I'm going to be leaving this week. My time is up." And two of the women are going to be actually leaving to go into another facility, and they're going to remain friends. They became so close in the last month or so they've been there that they both made it a point of telling me, "Yeah, we're going to be friends." And so providing, just like you're saying, Julianne, that kind of support, and they become their own support network, and it is such a neat thing to see.
It is, and then that's one of the steps for them getting out of isolation and shame and saying, okay, somebody else has gone through something really similar to myself, so therefore I feel like I've got a little more pull towards making it. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to watch how they can end up working together. It's beautiful.
It really is. And I think they, you know, there's so many things in common, understand each other's feelings, and just knowing that we really do need each other, especially in the midst of going through a journey like this. We're so much stronger and better together. And I think that we all see that played out just every day, really, in the residents we get to work with. We're just as fortunate because we learn from them in a similar way, as I'm sure they're benefiting from us as well.
Right. And what amazed me also, and you have this in your statistics also, Vicki, with how many of the women have come in with childhood abuse histories and have never had counseling until they come into the shelter and start getting those services. And it's amazing just to see some of the seeds planting of healing. You know, some of the women have never told their stories before.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm just looking up. We have discovered that nearly two-thirds of the clients that we serve have reported that they were abused as children. No surprise, because I think we know this anecdotally, but now we're seeing it and we're able to demonstrate. Yeah, it's that prevalent. So you're absolutely right. And many times, as you say, those issues were never dealt with or never taken care of early on. So now is an opportunity for many of the adults to heal even some of their childhood wounds. And we do our best to provide a safe environment for that to happen.
Right. And then also, we've worked with some of the children who, you know, even if they're really little, you can tell, I mean, there's signs of abuse also, you know, just by the way that they behave with each other or have temper tantrums or go hide or just have, you know, hair trigger reactions to things. And it's, you know, that's really tricky working with the children also.
You're right. And the thing that we know is that any child who witnesses abuse is much more likely to become an abuser. And, you know, and I think that is the biggest tragedy of all, because not only are they victims, but then with, you know, if these things are not treated, identified and treated when they're young, then many times this cycle will perpetuate. And that's why we say at Tsukasa too that, you know, our goal is to really break the intergenerational cycle of abuse, because it really is.
It is. Yeah, especially if, you know, a lot of the women are going through day-to-day survival skills, you know, maybe they're not thinking twice about what's happening with their children. Or maybe sometimes that's the red flag as to, you know, I'm tough and I can go through this situation. But once you start hurting my child, that's a different situation. And that's, I've heard a lot of those stories of, you know, the abuser was abusing me, but once they turned onto my child, that was it. That was the straw that broke the camel's back, period. That was it.
I've heard that many, many times too, Julianne. And in talking to some of our residents over the years, that is exactly what they say. That, you know, when it got to the point that perhaps the children weren't physically abused, but they were becoming manipulated emotionally and becoming affected, really impacted by the abuse between the parents, that's when she says enough. And I've heard that a lot.
Yeah, and then they're expected to hold the family secrets together.
Exactly. Which, again, I think is why it takes about, on average, 7 times to leave.
Right. I know. Until that final red flag goes up and that's it.
Yeah.
Right. So what can a woman expect after going through therapy and getting herself reestablished as to, you know, maybe I can have a better life here, and this is the first major step in me reestablishing my own identity, my own life, somebody else not telling me what to think and do and say and be.
Mm-hmm.
What happens after the 30 to 45 days if they stay the whole time for the program? Because we know some women have left prematurely. So what happens when they stay the whole program? What's the next step after that?
Well, you know, I think we know that 30 days isn't enough to kind of turn around a whole, you know, pattern that has been established perhaps over years. So the best we can hope for within the 30 to 45 days is, like I said, just to help the family to stabilize, to get out of harm's way, to hopefully start getting some things in place. The thing I haven't mentioned too, Julianne, is in addition to counseling, there's this whole other piece that's called case management, which really is what that means is it's a way of helping teach people to access community resources, teaching people how to go down to the Department of Public Social Services and apply for CalWORKs benefits, to go to other, you know, community agencies and really take care of themselves. So we kind of model some of that and impart those skills. So we realize that 30 days isn't enough to really get completely healed and through their whole process. So at the end, what will happen, the normal progression is that once they leave, when they're ready to leave, as I was referencing these other two women, what they've been able to find housing elsewhere outside of Tsukasa, actually even in another county, which is a safe area for them, in a transitional shelter. And so what that is the next stage for most folks. The next stage is going to be a longer stay, again in a domestic violence environment, meaning it's confidential location, meaning that the counseling staff is trained and certified to work with this population. But it is a longer stay because, again, research shows that the longer a victim can stay away from the perpetrator, the greater his or her chances are for long-term healing and survival, and she won't go back,
mm-hmm.
or he won't go back. So that's what we know. So we try to move them on to a transitional shelter. If that doesn't happen, then another safe housing situation, in some cases it's with a family member who's out of the area who can help this person get back up on her feet or his feet, but something like that would be longer term.
Mm-hmm. So how long in general is a transitional shelter going to let the woman or man and family sometimes stay with them?
Well, most of them are up to a year. I have heard of some that are 2 years, but for the most part, it's a year. I know our transitional shelter, which is a 24-bed shelter with 5 apartments, it sort of is customized depending on the needs of the family, but no less than 3 months and up to a year. It really is depending these days upon, like I said, the situation, the unique circumstances, and the needs of that particular family. But it, Probably you'll find that for the most part it's a year.
Okay, and within that year then they can start maybe getting a job, the kids can get into a school where they're going to be at for a while, so they can, you know, it's a new normal of pattern, for, a new pattern of normal for them, correct? So it's...
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. And it really, it's kind of like we take a lot of the same elements, the same program components that they received at the emergency shelter, and really just kind of expand them and enhance them over the year-long stay at transitional. What we find there is that there are greater opportunities for more in-depth psychotherapy, for example. Treatment plans are more intensive, more extensive. And like you say, yeah, one of the requirements that we have at our transitional shelter is that the adults are either working or in school and have a source of income, and that the children, school-age kids, are enrolled in school. Younger ones are in daycare or preschool. So that during regular, like, business hours, the shelter is pretty much empty. You know, it's after they get back from school and work that a lot of the programming takes place. And the other thing I want to mention, because I think it's significant, in the effort to help these families become independent, become self-sufficient, and be ready to move on to the next stage after the year, we ask them to save half of whatever their earnings are, whether it's public assistance or if it's wages from a job. And we save 50% of that for each family in a trust fund, a trust account, that they receive when they leave. And that becomes a nice deposit on the next apartment or some kind of nest egg. We've had families leave and they can purchase a car. So it's a real neat way to get them launched into their new life.
Right, into independence and hopefully self-sustenance.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really important, I think, because you had brought up a really good point before, Vicki, about, you know, sometimes the women go back because they're like, they get afraid. I can't make it without him financially. Mm-hmm. And so they backtrack. And I don't know. I mean, what are the statistics on women that backtrack? Does anybody follow that at all? Are there any studies that you know of that have worked with women like that?
Not that I'm aware of. The hard part on with regard to tracking a lot of victims when they leave shelter and come back is that a lot of this is confidential. We don't require that they give a forwarding address, for example. And they're a fairly transient population, as you would imagine. I would love to see some data on that, and I'm not sure. There may be some, but we'll keep looking.
Yeah, that would be really interesting, because I think that would be a really good point as to, you know, if a woman is, or a man, if are wanting to go back to their partners and just say, you know, well, you know, chances are that this might happen to you, and try to convince them to keep moving forward and not go back because of fear.
Right.
It's tricky.
Well, you're right. And, you know, and I will say, although I don't have the numbers, but I will say in all honesty that we know that we have served women that have returned to the batter. We know that for a fact. And even after they've been with us in transitional for a fairly lengthy time. And it's, you know, and it's kind of interesting because I think over time, staff, our attitudes have sort of changed about that, too. And that is it's probably not the worst-case scenario. I think ultimately where the field of domestic violence needs to go is to take a look at really treating the whole family unit when that becomes a possibility, and that the healing needs to take place with everyone. Now, clearly not when they're in the middle of a crisis or a dangerous situation, but ultimately I think that's where we need to go as a field.
Right, and I think that there needs to be services available for the abuser. I remember I was on the phone one time with an abuser, mm-hmm. and he had said, I want to get some help. I went to look to see where the resources were, and I came across one, maybe two places that work with the abuser, and I was shocked that that's all that they have. And I think those services need to expand, because it's really hard for the family to change if the abuser cannot change or does not have the resources to go and get that help.
That's really true. Now, I know of fairly well-known organization, actually started right here in Long Beach, the Association of Batterers Intervention Programs. And the founder, one of the founders, Alice LaViolette, is from Long Beach, and she's actually written some books on this very thing, and works with batterers. You're right, there aren't enough, and we really do need to see, I think, more resources and more opportunities to kind of pay attention to both sides of the equation.
Yes.
You know, the perpetrator and the victim, if you will.
Right. Because a lot of times also the abuser has a history of childhood abuse.
Absolutely. More often than not.
Right. And they're just repeating what they saturated up when they were kids, or, you know, lashing out because, you know, they had gone through the cycle. So it's, yeah, I agree with you, Vicki. The services need to expand.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you were talking about the funding before for mm-hmm. the shelter. And do you know how many shelters have closed up over the years because they did lose the funding?
Let's see. I know when things started getting particularly bad was about 3 years ago, and I am pretty sure I know of at least three that have closed in the LA area. Other programs have reduced their scope. They've had to close different components. They haven't shut down entirely, but I do know there's one in LA, and I think a couple others in the area that have closed due to lack of funding.
Yeah, that's very sad. And
it
then
is.
It makes it puts more stress on resources, and it puts more stress on Tsukasa and other shelters that are out there. It's because, you know, the numbers start increasing, and the staff, you just sometimes just don't have enough staff to be able to help everybody out there that you can.
That's right. Yeah, you know, I think we're all trying to do more with less, mm-hmm. and to work more efficiently. At the same time, it's a tricky thing from where I sit to kind of keep an eye on Tsukasa staff to make sure they're not burning out, to make sure they're not taking on too much, and balancing that up against budget constraints. It is difficult, and I've certainly heard that from other shelter directors. So we're just lucky and blessed that we have the staff that we have that stay for as long as they do, you know?
Yes, definitely. Great staff. Most definitely. So can you just, as we're wrapping up, state some of the services that Tsukasa provides, and then how someone can get in contact with the shelter and maybe tap into those resources?
One of the probably the best way to find out from a personally what kind of services that we offer, if you're looking for direct domestic violence classes or counseling or whatnot, I would say the best thing to do is to call our 24-hour hotline. Should I give them the number?
Yes, please.
Okay, so it's 562-402-4888. And that is our primary number for everyone for the public. And by calling the hotline, whether you're in need of shelter services, whether you're in need of just some referrals, or like I said, counseling, another other things that the general public may want to know about is that we do have staff that are trained to provide presentations, to go out on speaking, give a speaking engagement, to talk a little about not just our organization, but like we've done here on this show, in general, about domestic violence and the impact on families. So we have those services available as well. Let's see. And we also have a walk-in center. We call it a business center, and that is available for people who just, you know, are interested in finding out more, like I said, again, on a walk-in basis, maybe where to go, what to do, or you have a friend that needs some help. You're welcome to just kind of walk in, and we have brochures and some other resources. We also are always in the market for donations, and so that would be another way to make contact. We've got on our website, we've got a list of donations, needed items at any point in time, so I would advise you to take a look there first to see what we need.
Okay.
And then
and what
if
is
you're
that
interested
web-
in
oh, I'm
making
sorry.
The donation, you can call and we'll make arrangements.
Okay, and what is that website, Vicki?
And it's www.sucasa, S-U-C-A-S-A, D like domestic, V like violence, .org. So sucasadv.org.
Great. And there's so much information on that website also.
And we're soon going to be revamping it, and there'll be even more. So,
okay.
Yeah, but that's probably a good place to start. And there are some links, and I think, too, calling the hotline will kind of plug you into whatever it is you're looking for by calling that one main number. The 402-4888 number is probably the best bet.
And also there is the 211 number. Is that just within the state of California?
Yes, I believe it is, and it might be, gosh, Julianne, I'm trying to think. It might be a county. I think it may be in L.A. County, which, of course, is as big as a state in itself. But the 211 is also a very, very good resource for any social services. They'll refer you to really just about any type of human services that you need.
Wonderful. So, Vicki, thank you so much for being my guest tonight.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. And there was so much information, so helpful.
You bet. Anytime.
Thank you, Vicki. And
sure.
That was Vicki Doolittle, the executive director of SUCASA, Ending Domestic Violence. And that wraps up our program for Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Thank you so much for listening in. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to contact me, Julianne Good, at 562-234-4650. And my email is jgood8@verizon.net. Feel free to contact me anytime. I would love to hear from you. And if for some reason you would like to hear this broadcast again, we are on iTunes under podcast at Psych 1-on-1, P-S-Y-C-H 1-on-1. And there's about 50 shows right now. Tap into it anytime you want to. And it will also be archived again at skidrowstudios.com. I would like to give my sincere thanks to Jenny Guzman, my board operator, and Jeremy Hansen, the executive producer. Thank you so much. You guys rock. And thank you so much for joining me on Psych 1-on-1. This is Julianne Good. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Bye now.